This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book has a catchy title. It's titled The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. Love that. The author is joining me from California, Kip Colson. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Thank you.
Pleasure visiting with you. You are a numbers guy. I can tell by your book. You have 340 pages. That's a pretty good number. Share a little of your background history and how this book got written.
Sure. Well, the quickie background is I got out of college in 1967, went to Bank of America, became a banker, and did that for about 11 years, became vice president and head of a real estate department at a local office. One of my clients, who was a real estate developer, asked me to join him in his commercial development firm. So I did about 11 years in real estate development up until the early 90s when the real estate market was not very good, and so I needed to keep income coming in and change from the development world into the financial planning world. And I've been in financial planning since basically 1993.
Financial planning from a consumer standpoint is one that's filled with mystery. You love detail, apparently, in order to get a grasp on the best way to approach finances. Your book, is it something that will be available to someone like me who is absolutely indigent when it comes to finances and laying up that nest egg for the future?
I believe so. I really designed the book to be applicable to anybody who has to deal with finances, but understanding that unlike most other financial advisors in our world who only focus on the money side, in our experience, we try to focus with the combination of the people side of the family and the money side, because what we've learned in coaching families is that we never know for sure which is impacting the other. Sometimes the money is impacting the relationships in the family, unfortunately, negatively. And then sometimes, because of family dynamics, it impacts the financial well-being of the family. So we are, I think, one of the few financial planning firms that really addresses both of both sides of the family concurrently. So a lot of times families will go out and get the relational therapist to help them with the people side, and then they get the financial advisors helping with the money. But if those two aren't coordinated and collated in a fashion where they're working together, then the family still goes into a destruction mode.
Is that the underlying theme of Chapter 2? Why is this happening to my family?
Exactly. The term, the scientific term is called entropy, and entropy is the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says everything in the universe is basically going from the complex to the simple. And families are no different. Once you start to throw a lot of complexity into the family, and unfortunately wealth is usually one of those things, so the more things people own, the more opportunity there will be for the family to start fighting over those things. And the biggest issue is trust, and communication deteriorates to a point where the family just completely falls apart, unfortunately.
From your experience and oversight of families in distress financially, for example, those who are maybe small business owners or trying to get something launched or are self-employed as I am, a DBA, finances are not always predictable. You can't always plan a simple retirement set aside. What is the easy solution to that, or is there one?
Well, again, we like to think that planning is at least a positive solution to that, in the sense that you're right. There's no perfect world, and all the planning in the world isn't necessarily going to solve all of the problems. But planning, the old cliche is, if failing to plan is a plan to fail. And especially, again, when we're dealing with families, and as you just indicated, with businesses, the minute you put a business ownership or business enterprise into the family, that complexity goes way up. The analogy I like to use is that it's a little bit like having the family airplane, and mom and dad know how to fly it, but then at 30,000 feet, they decide we're getting out, we're going to let the kids figure out how to get this thing back to the airport and get it on the ground. Well, that's just not going to work. It's going to be a plane crash. So unfortunately, even business owners, they may do really well operating their business, but for whatever reason, all of those skills never transfer to their family. And so if you use good business succession planning, we actually like to use the word progression instead of succession. If you use good business progression planning and take those same disciplines and apply them into the family, that's really what we do, is we take that, how do you plan now to make that transition so that when mom and dad are gone, that next level of management just moves right up and keeps going because they're already up to speed.
The title, The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach in quotations, the significance of that, where did that title come from? Are you just one of those guys that likes to have a play on words, or how did that come about?
Well, I do like to have a play on words, so that's probably part of it. But the bigger issue is, which goes kind of the underlying theme of the book, is you have to have the right wisdom that works time and time again. And we just found that that wisdom is based in biblical wisdom. And so really it's a mix. The book is a mix of real world challenges and tools and strategies, but then backing that up with the fact that we've got this biblical wisdom. And when I looked at it, I went back and I said, well, really the whole concept of the Father, Son, Holy Coach, or Holy Ghost, was a little bit of a play on words. And because what we do is the coaching aspect of working with families, we just felt like there was that connection where that we've got the model in place. We just got to follow that model, and we got to follow the rules that the model established. And so hence, that's how the name came about.
Well, Kip, this is, I guess, would be referred to maybe as a teaching book, perhaps. Do you have real-life incidences or stories that are included in your book?
Yeah, I do, and a few of those stories are, as you say, real life in today's world, and then there's quite a few really real life stories, again, based on biblical stories. So, for example, the conflict between Jacob and Esau is in there, and it's a classic one. The struggle that King David had going through his family, and basically his whole family being destroyed, and his own son attempting to kill him. And it all goes back to this destruction based on this lack of trust and communication. So, yeah, there's a little bit of both the real world today and, there's no names, but, there's real world people that we deal with every day, as well as historical people.
Do you have to have a spiritual bend in order to enjoy the book, or is this something that will appeal to anybody that has an interest in finances?
I really designed this book to not be geared only to one, I'll call it the Christian world. I really wanted this book to have wide application, and my hope is that everybody can pick up this book no matter what their belief is, and I actually say that several times in the book, and that a lot of the principles, a lot of the rules that apply here really don't depend on your faith background. It really is just good, I'll call it common sense. And if you apply these rules, no matter what you believe personally, it can change your life. And that's really to answer your question, I really wanted this to be very broad in the sense of reaching everybody that needs the help that we like to think this book can provide.
Would you call your style easy to read, easy to understand, and easy to follow?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, I would tell you that a lot of times the compliments, if you will, that I get from a client is that, wow, you really made that easy for me to understand. So that's really the attempt. I mean, it is, especially when you're dealing with family dynamics, that can be very complex. But I'd like to think that I've boiled it down, if you will, to a level where it's going to be easily related by anybody who reads the book.
You have over 21 chapters. The last three, I think, are provocative and thought-provoking. Number 19, what will your family story be? That is a provocative title and a challenge. And then you have a step-by-step wrap-up and the last one word. That's a last wrap-up of the layout of your book. What is the inspiration or the challenge of what will your family story be?
Well, again, I think, unfortunately, in today's world, with the busyness, with the technology, what we've, and also with the geographical dispersion that families have, we don't have the tradition. We don't have the principles and the values necessarily being transferred from one generation to the next. Again, legally, the money side, the financial side of a family has to transfer because of estate planning and legal requirements. But the transfer of the values and the principles of a family just isn't happening. And so a large part of what you just described in those last three chapters are really saying, here's how you hold it all together. Here's how you keep the family as a unit, even though they are geographically dispersed, and give them a purpose for life that can go far beyond just gathering more and more assets. And, you know, and one of the examples I always talk about when I'm talking to clients is, you know, why do we know the names Kennedy and Rockefeller and Getty and some of these people that we've known for history? Well, it's because early on they realized that the family was the brand. The family was what we needed to hold together, and if we kept it all together, we would actually both financially and relationally benefit everybody in the family much more than if we give it away. And statistically, throughout history, wealth, about 70% of the family wealth gets lost every time it moves from one generation to the next. So in effect, by the end of the third generation, what mom and dad created back here will be completely gone and the kids will be without. In fact, the proverb everybody uses in our industry is called shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations.
Wow. That's challenging. You, in Chapter 9, one thing that's certainly very valuable about the way you've outlined the book is if you look at the chapter heading, you kind of get an idea of what's included in that chapter. Chapter 9, values are more valuable than valuables. I think that tells a story just in itself. Kip, you're dealing with a very complex issue. Is this a book that will answer everything? Is this all we need as far as finances, or do we need someone else involved in the process?
Jay, that's a really good question. And the answer is this book is not a self-help book in the sense that you can read through it and then go off and do everything yourself. And in fact, I even in the book encourage people not to attempt to do that because they'll make very serious mistakes. And again, we're dealing with relationships, so these are the kind of mistakes that can have very long-lasting impact on a family. We really believe that you need to have a third-party, objective, non-attached, somebody who can kind of look beyond the forest for the trees, also see the emotions, can feel those emotions that the family's going through, can see the body language, and can see where the breakdown in communication is happening. So we strongly recommend that the family always try to include a coach to help them with these problems. And again, not just the family therapist or the financial advisor, but the coach who can blend those two activities so they're working together.
Well, that's good advice. Having someone that is not emotionally vested in the process is certainly a very important bit of advice.
We believe so.
How long did it take you, Kip, to complete your book?
Well, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of fun in that I think that in round numbers, I'm probably about 12 months, about a year. And interestingly enough, I was able to write that on my cell phone.
Really?
Kind of, Yeah, well, that's always the reaction. But that's because I always had my cell phone with me. So anytime I had downtime, whether it be lunchtime, whether I'm sitting in an airport, whether I'm waiting in the doctor's office or whatever, I could always pull out the cell phone and start working on the book. So, about 12 months.
That's phenomenal. And again, 340 pages. Kip, is there another book in the future? Is there a follow-up to this one, The Legacy Family?
Well, the answer is I'm not sure, but yeah, I've been given some thought. I'd like to try to maybe do something a lot shorter that's geared towards the children in the family, starting to prepare them, because again, what we've seen too often is, and that's really the whole point of the book, is mom and dad unfortunately aren't doing a great job of preparing their children to deal with not only, again, the money side of the family, but also the people side. So, yeah, I'd like to maybe follow it up with a book that's a little bit geared more towards the youth and start to prepare them and really have it as a tool that mom and dad can sit down with their kids and start teaching them how to handle money.
Fabulous. This, your first book, is titled The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. My guest, Kip Colson. That's with a K, K-I-P. K-O-L-S-O-N. Kip, my listeners need to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
Well, they can go right directly to www.kipcolson.com. It's also available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and at West Bow Press.
Fabulous. They can also go to the local bookseller and ask them to order it in for them. The title again, The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Honored to visit with you. For Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Reading for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I have the pleasure of visiting with an author who has written a book titled From the Moon with Love, Book 1, Moon Guests. And joining me from somewhere near New York City, actually I think it's in Stamford, Connecticut, is former Ambassador Mitra Vasit. Thank you for joining me today.
Hello, thank you very much, Jay. And hello to everyone who's listening in. I'm Mitra, calling in from Stamford,
yes,
near New York.
Great to talk with you. You have written this book, obviously, by the cover. It's a book that perhaps is designed for a younger audience. Where did the storyline come from? You have mentioned that you have traveled all over the world and must have a very creative mind to create this book. How did this come about?
Oh, I don't know about my creative mind. I was India's diplomat and we did have chances to work our imagination, but normally we were not imaginative. We followed orders and improvised on the spot. I did get a spurt of imagination from my grandkids and their friends whom I interact with. And I came to the conclusion that the most imaginative community in the whole world is probably kids.
Oh,
they
yeah.
are unfettered and their imagination runs high. That's where I got my inspiration.
Absolutely. You have two main characters. One lives on the moon, I believe, and the other on Earth. Is that a correct descriptive of the two main characters?
Very accurate, Jay. Very accurate.
And how did they become acquainted?
Well, I have my little granddaughter. She's all of 3.5 years old and she loves stories, and I keep making up stories for her. And the one that she loved best was that she was gazing up at the moon. And I said, yes, she does have a friend up there. And since she loves the moon, I told her stories and it built up from there. And she did believe that she had a friend over there. And then I thought, children have a way of believing, and if the elders give substance to those beliefs, they end up really making something of their imagination. And so I just let the moon girl come alive. That's what I did.
You've called the character Luna, which is also another term for moon.
That's right. I mean, that was, it's not much of an inspiration. It was an obvious choice of name, but she used to call Luna. She said, Meets is anything lunar is the girl called Luna. So it came from my granddaughter, actually. My granddaughters, I have two of them. One is Zoe and one is Lida. And Zola is a combination of the two girls.
Actually, because it is a children's book, it's a relatively short book, I think under 40 pages, but there is dialogue in here. It's not just a picture book. How long did it take to put the story to paper and get it ready for publication?
The story bit of it didn't take very long because I had it in my mind. All I had to do was just write it out. What took ages was to get it into the format that was required by the publishers. By the way, I work with a very, very nice set of publishers called Archway, and they guided me. They had a set of regulations and rules and this many lines and this many pages, etc. So fitting it all into that took up more time than actually the story did.
You have two characters primarily, but they're in your story. Are there any conflicts or problems that they need to solve?
Oh, they have a huge problem to solve. The whole story is how there were warriors earlier on, and the earth and moon were very friendly. And together they ruled this part of the world, and you know they took their guidance from Brahm. And I haven't called it worshipping Brahm, but that is exactly what it was. And they got their guidance from a book. You know, the book used to appear wherever required, whenever required, gave them instructions. And between the moon and the earth, they ran a beautiful world. And the point I was trying to make was that as long as everything was loved and everything was equally loved and cared for in the universe, all that was created by God, humans, animals, plants, etc., and there was harmony around, everything was working beautifully. But then there was one distant planet who did not, and the leader of that, who did not like the supremacy of the moon and the earth, and therein lay the destruction and the conflict. And the book talks about a great war when Dread, his name is Dread, he came in with his warrior, spread poison on earth, and the good lord, that is not the good lord, I mean Brahm, sort of immediately made sure that the path from the moon to the earth was destroyed so that Dread couldn't reach the moon, because his original plan was to get earth and moon together, destroy them and take over both the planets and rule. He hated the Juno and Cairns, who are the two protagonists, you know. Earth warrior leader is Cairn and Moon warrior leader is Juno, and Dread wanted to kill both of them, take over and become the Lord and Master. And the Great War sort of destroyed the Earth, but it kept the Moon alive. And then this story picks up from how Moon is resuscitating these old times. And both Luna and Zola have a very big role to play in the Great Restoration.
Your chapter 3 talks about the Moon Secret and how Zola deals with an all-encompassing problem about her dream. What was the dream that was so challenging for Zola?
Oh, Zola dreamt that her friend Luna, and Zola kept talking to Luna and saying, why don't you come down for my birthday? Why don't you visit me? Why don't you see me? Why don't you respond? And then I go to the moon, and then Zola and Luna knows that the moon people can see the earth people because their powers were not destroyed. But the earth people can no longer see the moon people, and that's why Zola cannot see Luna waving to her every day. And the grandmother feels so bad because Luna says, Zola's crying, can you please let me go in her dream at least? And Luna comes in her dream and says, Zola, I know you, I hear you, you can't see me, there is a secret. We have to be 6 years old to know the secret. My grandmother wouldn't tell me the secret, but... And that's where I take it.
You're taking it that way. She also has some siblings, some brothers that are a part of the story.
Oh, yes. Anton and Vladan are the siblings of Zola on Earth. And they are both in on the secret because they're over 6 and they got initiated when they were 8. And Luna on the moon also has her two siblings. She has her sister and her brother who also know what's going on. And the grandmother knows what's going on. And what is going on is that there is going to be a restoration when Earth will be restored back to its glory, and when the moon and Earth will become partners again, and they'll have to find a way of knowing what happened after the Great War. That is the mystery that comes up in book number two, which I'm finishing just now.
Oh, phenomenal. You have had this story and been telling it to your, or sharing it with your grandchildren. Are there other children that have been exposed to this? Have you shared this story with other children? What's been the response?
Oh, no, I have been invited to many schools in Stanford and some in New York also, because the book has been circulating for a little while. And the children who have listened to me have found it fascinating when I read it to them. And they ask me the most wonderful questions. And because the whole thing is on a philosophic realm, I've been trying to tell them that the whole story is how one should be equal-minded and keep, you know, the peace and harmony of the earth, which is what God intended, without upsetting it. And when that is the case, then everything is beautiful and everything runs like a lovely current. You know, when that is upset, then things are upset.
What's the most enlightening or exciting or maybe even funny question that children have asked you?
Oh, yeah. Some of the boys asked me, are you going to make it a girl's book? I said, well, obviously not. It's not a girl's book because you have three important protagonists over there. One is Luna's brother and two are Zola's brothers. Without them, the story cannot move. And the book itself proves that. And some of the girls wanted to tell me, will you please keep the primacy role of the girls, please? You know, that was a 9-year-old girl who said it. So I said, I think it will unravel that way. But without everybody's contribution, nothing's going to work. So this book is also about how everyone has a part to play in everything, you know, whether it's a play or a charade or a drama or real life. And unless all the parts are played with harmony, the result is less than optimal.
Other grandparents, have they also given you feedback on the story?
Oh, they loved it. The elder, in fact, I think the adults who've read my story have found it very fascinating. Some have tried to draw parallels here and there. And I told them my mind is clear as crystal. No messages are intended. Certainly nothing political. It's just that I value the imagination and the purity of kids. And this book is only about celebrating their imagination and not curbing it, just letting it go.
Well, beautifully done. The illustrations, how long did that take to complete, to get them where you wanted them?
No, I was asked to give very detailed descriptions of the type of illustrations I wanted, which I did, down to the last detail. Including that one of the twins, Zola's brothers, one should have brown eyes, the other should have blue eyes, because there is a story to it that will come out in my number two volume. And the illustrators from Archway Publishing were absolutely wonderful. It was a great relationship I shared with them.
Well, it's fascinating that you were able to get this done. A lot of grandparents and even parents have stories they tell their children, but they don't develop into books. So this is a great accomplishment on your part, and also your personal history as an ambassador also is a stunning thing. Is that something that you might weave into a child's story in the future?
That's what my grandson, my grandkids, I have a son and a daughter, and my son has three kids and my daughter has two. So my son's son, the eldest of my grandkids, is Kiran. He's about 7 and a half. And he says, Meets, I want books. Meets, I want books. And then he loves stories about when I tell them stories about Bangkok, Sri Lanka, Bhutan. Well, you know, both my kids were, they grew up in Bhutan for a while when I was posted there. They were both born in Austria. So my grandkids love to hear about how their parents were born in Austria, how they lived in Bhutan, et cetera, et cetera. And my grandson keeps telling, he's all of 7 and a half. He keeps telling me, Meets, when are you going to write that book about being an ambassador? Meets, when are you going to write that book about being an ambassador? So that's the way it goes. I probably end up doing it just for my grandson.
Well, I hope to visit with you when that's completed, too. This particular first edition is From the Moon with Love, Book 1, Moon Guests. And my guest author has been Mitra Vasiste. Thank you for joining me today. Where do my listeners, where can they get a copy of this publication?
Oh, they can get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and I must say the electronic copy is reachable. It's very, very eminently reasonably priced, and that's easy to get to. So I hope they find a way of reading the book and getting some feedback to you, and you can tell me about it.
They will be able to also do a search under your name. Your first name is spelled Mitra, and Vasiste is spelled Vasisht. So they can find you by doing a search, but particularly from the book title, From the Moon with Love. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. This is fascinating, and look forward to visiting with you when book two hits the bookshelves.
And there's only one more point I'd like to say.
Sure.
I have a website, mitravasis.com. They can find details on that also.
All right, and would you spell that out for them, please?
It's MitraVasisht, all in lowercase, .com. It's my name, .com.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mitra, for joining me today and sharing your story. This is a fun book, and parents, grandparents, you should get a copy because this is the season for giving, so you will enjoy reading From the Moon with Love. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Jay.
My
Bye.
Pleasure.
Have a good holiday, all of you.
Yes, for Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title of the book, Management Diseases and Disorders, the recipe for dysfunction in the marketplace, I guess would be the way to describe it, 56 Diseases and Disorders. Joining me from California, the authors, Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes, Ph.D. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Hello.
Well, I guess it's a couple of sirs. A couple of sirs, not just a sir. You gentlemen have written a book that is unique in its own right. I'm kind of curious as how it was you gentlemen got together and wrote this. What was the glue that put it together?
Well, Peter and I work for the County of Orange government in California. Peter, I was there 33 years. Peter was there, I think, 17.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so that's how we met. We met when he was the internal auditor for the county, and I was the performance auditor and later became the chief human resources officer. And we had a lot of overlapping things that we did. So kind of at the culmination of our careers there, I was... looking at the internet one day, and I just happened to see a book on medical diseases, and I was kind of skimming through it and having a good time with that. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, I thought, you know what? In management, we have our own diseases and disorders, and they cause sicknesses to people, and they cause sicknesses to the organization.
Right.
And I started kind of the aha moment and started playing with it. And the more I got into it, and the more I started going back and forth between the analogies, I thought, I think we have something here, and with all our experience we've had in auditing in HR, maybe we could flesh this out. So I called Peter and said, hey, what do you think about this? Let's start talking. And when we got into it, we said, we got something here. And
yes.
So it started that way, and then shoot, a year later, we have a book out there on the market.
And it's actually written in the style of a medical book, is it not?
Yes, we did that very deliberately. We wanted to make it a handy field manual for anybody struggling in an organization. We got 56 diseases and disorders we identified, and we take it very follow that dictionary approach very closely. We have what we describe as a healthy and normal function of a leader or a manager, and then we talk about causes of dysfunction. We talk about risk to the organization of dysfunctional management behavior. We identify signs and symptoms. We give a diagnostic And then we talk about the progression and impact if not treated. And then we also identify treatments or cures. So for 56 different profiles, if you will, you'll find it easy to read, easy to absorb. And then for every one of the 56, we give a case study that is sort of a composite of our collective experiences.
So those case studies really are, as you say, composites. They're not necessarily a factual recounting of a problem, but it really does mirror things that you have seen in the workplace.
Well, it might be a little bit closer. We took things that we actually saw and experienced, and we tweaked them, changed the names, and, and made modifications to them. But they are based on things we did observe in various environments. Peter and I have worked in the public sector, private sector, educational sectors, and been successful at all those. And so we had tons of experiences and different things happen. And so that was part of the fun part of the whole thing, is putting those case studies together. And several of our people that we know that have read the book have told us the funnest part they've had is with those case studies.
They all connect with them. It doesn't matter where they worked. You know, they could be in the private sector, public, they can be in a government, they can be in a big or small company. Everybody has those, as Steve says, aha moment where they go, wow, I worked for somebody like that.
Yes.
And, you know, you asked us about our motivation. My motivation was pretty simple. You know, when I work in a healthy organization where the manager is getting it right, I love coming to work.
Absolutely.
You know, and so do my colleagues.
Yes.
You know, you actually look forward to it. And when you don't have good management, you really have the opposite. There have been, I've worked for managers where I dreaded getting out of bed on a Monday morning and going to work because I just knew that half the battle was going to be working through this manager's dysfunctional behavior.
Right.
So when we wrote it, we said, listen, let's spare our colleagues out there a lot of the grief that we've gone through trying to figure out at the end game to functionality. We had a phrase that we came up with. I don't know if it's original, but for us it was, is let's put the fun back into functionality. And then my wife said, well, you know, you can also put the fun back into dysfunctional behavior if you know the cure.
Absolutely.
And for us, going back to the medical kind of analogy, we've been in workplaces where the bosses have kind of mild dysfunctional behavior. It's like a common cold. Y'all can work through it. It's not that disruptive, and it has its own shelf life. But we've also worked in organizations where the dysfunctional behavior in the manager is pervasive and persistent and affects literally every decision that manager makes. And then it becomes contagious in the organization where everyone else starts exhibiting that kind of dysfunctional behavior. And before you know it, you know, you have a dysfunctional group.
Right.
Steve and I were talking before this interview about how we got to the point where we could walk into any organization and within, you know, a short while, we could call whether that was a functional operation or dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instances, we could do it in 30 minutes. Other times, it would take a half a day, but no longer. This book empowers any of the readers to make those quick calls or diagnosis without having to belabor it.
Yes. You have broken it down into two parts, basically. The first part is personality-based diseases and disorder, and then the second part of the book, culture, or system-based diseases and disorders, and within those are chapters, subchapters, and obviously the case studies, a total of 250 pages. The deficiencies or the personality-based diseases and disorders, which of those do you think is the most prevalent in the workplace?
Well, I don't know if you could say something's the most prevalent. We took the personality-based diseases and disorders and further broke them down into personal deficiencies that have to do with an individual's personality, the issues they have with that, and the interpersonal deficiencies with how they relate to other people. Then behavioral deficiencies, which we have three sections on that, which behaviors are based on fear, which behaviors are based on self-interest, and which behaviors are based on having a lack of skill set. So I don't know that one is more important, but certainly some of them are more crucial.
The one I'll say, Steve, I saw most common was what Steve is labeled as the divinity complex.
Right.
Where a person, it's a situation where you get inflated sense of your abilities upon promotion. That's not commensurate with reality. And it can be a kind of a light affliction, or it can be a pretty terminal one, depending upon the individual.
Yeah, and the idea with that was, you know, that when I got promoted to the job, instantly I became smarter, I had more experience, and I was infallible.
Yeah.
You know, just upon promotion.
And what can happen, we saw, is that you could get an average person promoted for a variety of reasons, some good, some bad, but they start thinking they're an Einstein. And in the process, they also start pushing out all the competent individuals because they make them feel inadequate.
Yes.
So they start surrounding themselves with a lot of less capable individuals who will, fawn over them and assure them that they're, the shopper's tool in the shed when they aren't. And that becomes very dysfunctional in an organization. We've seen it happen. We've seen the capable, competent producers leave that unit, or worse, become what we call the working dead. They just get stymied and stifled,
mm-hmm.
and resign themselves to not being effective anymore. I'd say that probably the most common experience or common profile we encountered, the divinity complex.
I've seen that in a few churches. I guess that would be okay there. I don't know. In your book, as you began to write this, did you think that not just management people and HR people? Do you think that the regular guy in the cube down the corridor might benefit from being able to identify maybe the leadership that surrounds him?
Yeah, I think that we've got two things that would help the line worker that's got the cubicle down the hall. One is to help you manage your manager. If you figure mm-hmm. out the problems that your manager has and you look in our book and work through it, you can start identifying strategies of how to deal with that. So rather than just sit there and kind of passively accept what happens, you can actually strategize and try to make it work for you. So that's one thing. Second thing is we really want people to look at this just like a medical book in the sense that we all have these. Hell, there's some of these chapters that Peter and I wrote. We go, hey, we've had these before. It's just like a common cold or the flu or a broken arm. Everybody's going to get one of these diseases. The point is, do you admit that you have it?
Yes.
And so we want people to do some self-examination and say, hey, gee, they're talking about me a little bit here. I need to work on that myself. So we hope they can manage their manager and they also can do some self-introspection.
Yes, that's the point, too. It's very empowering. We found we kind of designed this so that executives could coach their managers. We call the manager the managers could self-coach themselves, and then we could have a kind of a how to boss your boss, how to manage your boss mm-hmm. In the right direction. If just for instance, I've been in situations where I was overwhelmed with the responsibilities and the complexity of the job. My first reaction was just to kind of avoid conflict, and I kind of discouraged bad news. There was so much of it, I didn't want any more of it.
Right.
Well, that becomes a dysfunctional managerial approach and behavior if it's allowed to continue. Fortunately, I had some pretty seasoned people who saw those symptoms. And they reported to me, but they still were able to coach me out of that situation. So it's, a very empowering book for people who are working for a dysfunctional boss, for a boss who's struggling with the complexity of the organization, and for an executive who is seeing a boss stumbling.
Absolutely. You have a chapter or have a notation of a deer hunter boss or CEO. What does that represent?
That was one of the case studies. The idea was, I think it's not delivering bad news. It was a reference. We had an employee who was at work at a location, and it came to our attention that he had actually shot a deer while he was at work.
Okay.
And so we were like, excuse me? And so when we went out there, it turned out that, yes, it was true that the fella had shot the deer, but you couldn't convince him that he was wrong. He said, well, it was hunting season. I had my license. It was away from the work crew. I had a clean shot, you know. And so you're looking at this going, really? So we finally got to the point where the only thing that he would admit that something was wrong was that, okay, I did it at 4 o'clock, and I'm supposed to be working at 4 o'clock rather than 9.
Wow.
So the problem we had was, we had first talked to the supervisor, and the supervisor was kind of indignant about what had happened. And then we found out from the employee that the supervisor actually drove the guy down to the site where the deer was at, watched him shoot the animal, and then helped him load it into his truck.
Oh, phenomenal. Wow.
Yeah, and so, in fact, as I'm looking it up now, it's the fear of conflict, disease, and disorder. And the idea being, when we asked the supervisor, why did you do that? He said, well, I just didn't want to spoil the guy's day. He was having a good time. So I didn't want to be the boss and tell him he couldn't do it.
And that's incredible.
You know, it can be as simple as that. And with Steve's experience in HR, where he got the worst cases, the toxic personalities, where there was seemingly no cure, he was able to conjure up an antidote, if you will, for a lot of this dysfunctional behavior. Of course, wherever we had our successes, there was a fair amount of willingness to change.
Yes.
And a lot of that willingness, is person-dependent, but it also can be in the way you present options and alternatives to dysfunctional managerial behavior. The right tone and the right approach makes people more receptive to change. And we saw some really positive results by taking the approaches that we're recommending in our case studies.
Fantastic. The title of the book, again, is Management, Diseases, and Disorders. 56 diseases and disorders are outlined in the book, 250 pages or so. And the authors, Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes, have indicated and certainly displayed the fact that there is some fun in this book as well. It's not just tough reading. It is a managerial leadership style book, but employees can benefit from it as well. Sirs, where do I get copies of Management, Diseases, and Disorders?
It's available at really any outlet. Lulu Publishing was our publisher, so that's the first selection, but it's also on Amazon. It's also on Barnes & Noble. And if you go on the website, you can find other locations for it.
I have the impression that you might have had some fun doing this book, even though it was a year of your time. Is there a follow-up to this one?
Yes, about 3 or 4.
Yeah, we're trying to narrow down what we think we could do. We got a really great book review from Blue Ink Review. We got it last night. And, in fact, the fellow gave us a great thing saying it's an excellent book, well-written, insightful, clear, and concise. But he also said, hey, if you could go into more detail on the
that
would be your second book. So he's already given us an idea.
Fabulous.
Where to go.
I'll tell you, back to the first question you asked about, what got us motivated to write the book. Again, I'll kind of summarize it just to give people, Steve and I have 70 years of experience in management, and we kind of thought, well, let's write a book that someone can skim and, through in 70 minutes so that we can say, we'll give you 70 years of experience in 70 minutes.
Wonderful.
And fast forward you so you don't have to spend your whole career trying to to learn this, you can be turbocharged to where we are in a matter of just a few months of application.
It was fun, but it was also a pretty cathartic experience because you're sort of purging 7 years of experience out there. And while there's been a lot of fun in the process, there's a lot of very, very tough issues. In the public sector, especially at the county level, we deliver every kind of service that people need. And we have police officers, we have courts, we have health care, social services, parks, recreation.
Airports, harbors.
And so you get a diverse set of real-life issues that happen. And as you know, it's there's no shortage of what people can do in the workplace,
oh boy,
good or bad.
Absolutely.
We used to say that best antidote to a dysfunctional situation is a good sense of humor. But I will say, in addition to that, we think this book is a great antidote. We're very positive. We worked through some of the most demanding and almost scary type of situations to happy resolutions. So we really want to empower people to not be intimidated by the dysfunctionality in their organization or in their boss, because it's something that can be addressed and remedied.
Great. And one of the great commendations about this book is that both of you have worked on this for a year and are still talking. So that's probably worth the read by itself. You also have a website, I believe. Is it managementdiseasesanddisorders.com? Is that also your website?
Yes, sir, it is.
It's all one stream. No spaces, just managementdiseasesanddisorders.com.
Fantastic. Again, the title of the book, Management Diseases and Disorders, 56 diseases and disorders that are outlined in this book in a kind of a medical dictionary sort of approach. The authors, Stephen A. Danley and Peter Hughes, have joined me from California near Anaheim. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
Best of fun.
Best of luck for Indie Book Publishing Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.